A quick note before we get into today's episode. Sayer and I are working on growing the show to make it a better and better product for all listeners. And one way we're doing that is through Patreon. War Stories patrons get early access to all episodes, patron-only shows, and some behind-the-scenes access as we plan out future episodes and guests. If interested in supporting us directly, the link to do so is in the episode description, or you can head to our website, warstories.co. And as always, thank you all so, so much for your continued support. What's going on, everyone? Preston Stewart and Sarah Payne with War Stories. And I'm going to talk a little bit today about kind of what I was up to the last few weeks. We had a bunch of episodes, kind of the normal Friday episodes or interviews, conversation style. And this one's going to be a little bit different because for the last 2 weeks, I thought there was a chance I might be able to get something recorded, but no, I was off training at Fort McCoy and we're in open bays. There was no chance of actually getting an episode knocked out. So I'm glad we didn't plan on that.
No. Yeah. You were old school.
We actually, I guess I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth here. We had a couple others this week that fell through and just is what it is. But we intentionally blocked off those 2 weeks. I took all my equipment thinking maybe we'll get it done. But once I moved into the bay, you know, we shared a bay, open bunks with, there were probably 20 or 30 beds in a room. And you could just like reach over and grab the bunk next to you, right? They're like right next
to you. Were you top bunk or bottom bunk?
No, they're only bottom bunks.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Because that's sort of the dominant alpha dominance thing.
Is that, I don't know.
Oh yeah.
Wait, which one is the top or the bottom?
You don't want top bunk.
Really?
That's like prison thing. Oh yeah. And you don't want top bunk. It's just a lot easier on bottom bunk. Well, because you can chill out and sit there. But you know what? There's probably some top bunkers, if that's their preferred one, where they can, no one's going to sit on their bed and stuff. No, but I sort of had that feeling of this.
Oh no, you know what it is?
Oh
no, you take the bottom bunk and you put your stuff on the top bunk. Isn't that the move? And then, well, so then you kind of lock the whole thing down until somebody then has to come say like, hey, is somebody using this or is this you? And nobody wants to have that interaction. So you end up with your own place.
I would say this is all juxtaposed by not being, you know, a buddy effer, meaning this balance between prioritizing what your preferences are versus being selfish and greedy. Because you are in these public, you know, you don't know these people. You're meeting for the first time.
Yeah, didn't know anybody in there.
And well, so you don't want to come off as like this greedy person. Like, you don't want to be a greedy person. You know what I mean? But then again, you have your preferences. So it's that navigation. And that's, I think, a good healthy benefit, of course, of the military, let's say, where you're just thrown into this rando mix with people. You're a major now in like open bays. Old school, but I think that that's like healthy because it like, especially if you took away phones, which we can't, but it makes you all have to engage one another, right? Because if you were in your own little dorms or whatever, you're definitely just going in there and hiding out, not hiding out, but just chilling by yourself. If that's the option.
I mean, we all put headphones in and watch movies when we got back there anyways.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, so I do want to talk about the actual training we did because it was kind of eye-opening to me, but, this is where they housed a lot of the people for Operation Afghan Welcome. Did you know that? Fort McCoy, Wisconsin.
Oh, that is right. I never put that together. Mm-hmm. You are right about that. In fact, one of our former interpreters, who is now stranded in Turkey, he saw the writing on the wall October of 2020, and he fled. He had three kids. His wife was pregnant. And they fled through Pakistan into Iran, then to Turkey.
Wait,
well,
how do you do that?
Well, the border patrol sort of picks them up and moves them. Like say, we're not, you can't stay in Pakistan. We'll take you to
West
India. Well, I think they went south to eastish, northish to then west to Turkey.
Jesus.
The border patrol basically picked them up and said, hey, Pakistan, you can't stay here. We'll take you to Iran border though. Iran was like, hey, you can't stay here. We'll take you to Turkey border. That's how I understand it. But anyway, his brother was an interpreter and he's an American citizen in the United States. He's in our former brigade. Now he's a US citizen and an E5. And he got called to Fort McCoy in the middle of all this. He's not even like a linguist in the army, but just given this prior history, they just put him on random orders totally not related to his unit to serve at Fort McCoy for like probably like 4 months to deal with all that mess. It's like 80,000 people flew in with no plan.
It's crazy. I'd never heard of it before. And I guess that shows that I'm new to the reserves, because most people in the reserves are familiar with Fort McCoy. It's pretty big, man. There's a ton of stuff up there. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that this place was picked to house all of these refugees and not somewhere along the East Coast, or like, think of how much housing they have available just to turn on, and all of these bays that I was in, that's what they were using them for.
It's funny to see how we're still descended. Like, World War II is 80 years ago. Those guys are like 100 now. It is really, if you're like Gen Z or something, it really is ancient history. It's kind of like us growing up thinking about World War I or the 1800s almost. And like, but these are all like the World War II stuff. There's so many remnants of that are still around. Yeah, that's just how big and vast it really was across the country at that time.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting base. I didn't get to travel around as much as I'd hoped and look at other stuff, and didn't, and I will get into the training here, but like, they've got it all there, man. This random base in Wisconsin has multiple airfields. It's got something set up for a wet water crossing.
Really?
Yeah. So engineers can practice bridging a water obstacle. Like, I don't know how many bases actually have that set up to where it's not just, you know, I think like if your average military base has like a stream running through it, imagine all the regulations around bridging that thing to not ruin the stream and not contaminate it and not all of these crazy amounts of
stuff. That's a fair point. That's an interesting point just to note for other people that probably weren't aware. It's like you have local regulations and stuff like down at, you're right about that. You can't just dam a waterway all of a sudden, even if you're doing it for good, let's say with military training. It's the same thing when we had these down at Fort Benning is where I did all the infantry stuff. I was there for like 10 months and I can't think, there's a special bird down, a woodpecker maybe. And it like, it's a big deal. You can't get around these things. If these woodpeckers are around, it's like a protected animal. And you got to play around those sort of things too. Cause you are out in the woods and you're blowing stuff up.
So it's interesting. I mean, you know, all the small arms ranges, crew served weapons ranges, all that stuff, they have artillery firing points, I believe, definitely have some impact areas. Like, it's big. It's impressive. But anyways, to get into kind of what I was doing up there, stay at a high level. It was a big training exercise, you know, roughly brigade size element. And I was not in the field at all. So I was entirely in like a classroom office type setting in something called HALS, H-A-L-S-S, higher adjacent, lower supported and supporting. And I'm not gonna lie, it was not like the most exciting thing I've ever done by a long shot. But it was like eye-opening to what the military does in these larger training exercises. We had 40, 50, 60, 80 people. I don't know what it was. It split between a handful of shifts, role-playing units across this giant battle space, so that the training unit had all of this situational awareness in real time.
What was the size of the training unit?
About a brigade, but it was a ton of individual units. Cause on the reserve side, you don't have these, it's not brigade combat teams and infantry divisions. We've got a support company here and an MP platoon there and an ordnance company. And, you know, it's all sorts of support units. Some are tied together. But it's a lot of small units. If you hear Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion, 506, like, you can kind of piece that together, who they belong to, and keep track of, like, Alpha Company probably is next to, you know, Bravo Company. This was all over the map. It'd be like 794th Support Company, also works with 241st Medical Supply. Like, it was really hard to keep track of the org. I'd never kept track of the org chart. What was interesting was just seeing the outside view of this size training event. So at the squad, platoon, even company level, like, you can just go out to the woods and carry out a little mock mission. But the reality is, like, in a war zone, there's so many other things happening. So like, I played a unit that had no subordinate units. So these guys that were training would just see my reports and be like, oh, that's going on over there. And we were constantly essentially like making up traffic, making up reports, making up attacks, making up dispositions. Like there is a script, there's a huge, very complex script that's written for all of these things. And you constantly have these little injects throughout the day, but they're injects into training that the training unit doesn't actually do anything with. They just look over there and they're like, oh, there was a chemical attack 17 miles to our east in a different unit.
Are these scripts in play? Like, let's say JRTC, where this is the playbook for units to come in, or did you guys create these custom for this sort of training event?
No, similar to that JRTC type thing. This is kind of the JRTC type event for reserve units.
Oh.
The units that were out in the field, that's what this was. It's called CSTX. Oh, yeah.
You're getting up ready to go now. That's what that means.
Yeah. So
they're sending you guys, you're in the hot seat.
So this is their culminating event for this unit. And they haven't, and what's interesting to me, what was crazy was like, they have this type of thing multiple times a year all across the country. So like, this isn't unique. It wasn't special. It's a lot.
I think those things are pretty fun effort, to be honest. Yeah. I think they're pretty fun to be honest. Cause it's like, it is the essence of playing, like the whole camping with guns. Cause no one's dying right now. You know what I mean? It's like, you literally get to play army. And it's stressful because you're being evaluated and you got the people with the clipboards and all that stuff. And the boss is always watching, but that's always the case. At the end of the day, you get to like play army. And like, if you're an engineer, how cool is it that you get to do, you know, you talked about it and maybe you've done a bridge crossing, an AIT or something, but now you actually get to do it again. And like with your actual unit, which is going to be a little bit different, you're gonna have a little bit of different equipment and things like that. And it's always comes back to like, we got to figure this problem out. You know, like we're all together here. How do we figure this freaking thing out and then take direction and then sort of move forward? I think that stuff that's fun stuff.
So as I'm still kind of in deep with war in Ukraine and watching that and seeing what's happening there. This was something else that kind of caught my attention. Just being a part of this, the reserve doesn't really have combat arms units. It's essentially support, combat support, combat service support type roles. So there wasn't an infantry unit out there assaulting an objective. There wasn't an artillery battery conducting deep fires. There wasn't any of that. It was all logistics and support units.
Mm.
So this big training exercise was training logistics. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had to role play all of the kinetic stuff. Now they still had, you know, they'd still catch an IED. They'd still catch a mortar attack and they'd still have to defend against attacks, things like that.
Sure.
But the goal of this exercise was to dial in logistics. And I just, how often do you think of that when you think of the military, right? It's always shooting, kicking indoors.
My perspective on that, I agree with you. Those are the sexy things. Like I was just talking about the engineers doing the cool stuff. But, you know, we had this first sergeant who was just the epitome of a leader and humble and awesome, knowledgeable, just everything about him when during ROTC as like, and he was there for like, I feel like all 4 years. Maybe it was only the 3 years, but either way, I just, something that always rung in my head or stayed in my head was he said, tactics are for amateurs. Logistics are for professionals. And then just thinking about that and then go back to like history and war and things like that. That is a lot of it. It is the being able to move all that. And then go back to the numbers. We always talk, I remember hearing about that ratio. Let's just say easy math. It's like 10 to 1 or something of logistics to combat arms. I don't know if it's infantry or combat arms. Let's just say combat arms. It might be infantry, but either way, 10 to 1. I mean, there's 10 logisticians, behind the scenes type people. Could be mechanics or fuelers or just repair people, who knows, internet stuff, all that stuff needs done, satellites, 10 of those for every like sort of actual grunt. And so we definitely sure as hell should focus on that. That's a lot of people.
You know, tooth to tail ratio, I think people. Is what that's called, right? Tooth to tail.
I haven't heard it called that.
I think that's it. And I think it's, I think it's like 20 to 1. I could be mistaken.
See, and I think you're probably right too about that. Yeah. Which means that's actually the vast majority of people. And then I read another, what's another interesting thing about just logistics. It just got me thinking because I heard another, I don't know, Harvard Business Review or Business Insider, one of those sort of articles. And it was saying sort of the today path to being a CEO. Like, hey, you want to be a CEO? It used to be MBA type stuff and leadership and just personality. It could be even charisma, politicking, things like that. Traditional, let's say, leadership stuff. But now they're saying like the hard skill pathway to be the current trend is supply chain management. You know, coming up in those fields of just doing logistics. So now even that's the path of a CEO. And then think about when I was talking about the history part, the one that always also when I hear about that tactics are for amateurs. What comes to mind specifically historically is like North Africa and Rommel, where he had the tactics to he would win battles. And we as Americans weren't doing, that was pretty early on. We weren't doing too well. And Montgomery, the English, they were having a tough time, but we ended up prevailing because of the ally supply chains. Rommel would have these issues with the tanks that he could maneuver and beat the hell out of anybody in front of him. But you can't do that if you don't have gas. Sort of similar to what we saw initially into the sort of Russia fiasco, remember? And we've sort of talked about it, mm-hmm. where they had the manpower and sort of equipment, yeah, but only so far. Then it created a big pause because it was like that forward planning, because that's really strategy. Tactics is more just immediate. That's like the violence of action and gut instinct. But then it's like, well, at the end of the day, it's the long game. It's patience and strategy. And I think that is where, and it, again, is it sexy or anything like that? No, but I think that that's where the money is made.
Yeah. And something else that came to mind. So there's active troops there in McCoy. Got a chance to talk with a couple of them up there, active units. A lot of them, I think, exclusively tied into some sort of training role, OCT, because I think that's essentially
what's OCT?
Observer, controller, trainer.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
I think those are the only active units that are there, but I could be mistaken. But anyways, the whole concept of, and this has really hit home with the war in Ukraine as well, the whole concept of the reserve. I feel like we've always wanted to look, when I was active, I definitely looked at the Guard and Reserve and thought, who are these bums? Like, there's no way they're going to be as competent as the people on active. And I will mm-hmm. say today that there is no way I am as competent in a field artillery major role as an active duty major who's been doing it every day for 10, 12, 15 years. There's probably some bad ones and there's probably some good ones in the reserve that could swap out. But generally speaking, it's kind of naive to think that you could do something once a month and be as good as somebody who does it every day. But that's not the job. You just talked about the tooth to tail, 10 to 1, 20 to 1, whatever. How many of those roles could be filled with reservists and National Guard members that don't necessarily have to go toe-to-toe with an enemy force overseas? How many people would be needed to stand up a training environment at Fort McCoy if we mobilized for a larger war? Tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions that would stay stateside loading out containers. And that guy loading out containers and running ranges, like, you still have to do that in a time of war. And no, that person doesn't have to be a PT stud and qualify expert on every weapon system.
But we do that. We, you know what we decided to do here is we outsource that stuff to contractors and pay them 3x the going rate is what we do. And these corporations just, they have these contracts and they just, to me, that's part of this. That is the military industrial complex where it's like, you've got almost the military is part of me believes the military is here to support the industries because we've just associated war with profit and like economic prosperity. And so it's like, well, we can build businesses around here. And I used to live in Dayton, Ohio. I'm in Cincinnati now. Dayton's got it's got Wright Patt Air Force Base. And that's like, I think it's the largest Air Force base in the country and they do all their research there. So you have like, and it's a cool sort UFOs. Of hybrid. That's where the aliens would be. Yeah. That's where they would be. And like, I'm mixed on it because they have a great relationship. There's two different universities there, University of Dayton and Wright State. And then you've got a manufacturing base, strong manufacturing base, just in general in the Dayton area, sort of blue collar workers. But then you got these bases. And I tell my wife, when she would come to like Fort Campbell or something, when you go to lunch, like when you go to lunch in Dayton, Ohio, like you as a major are like the low man on the totem pole. You're like the equivalent of like a specialist. Like if you're just going to get lunch or something, it's a bunch of majors and colonels hanging out. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you go to Clarksville, it's sort of the E4 mafia. That's kind of the majority of people. And you may see one major in there at all. Something like that, where it's, but my point is, it's this balance because they're doing all this research with universities. They're doing it with private industry. And then they're also doing it with the active folks on the base itself. And so there's benefits to all of that, but I'm always just kind of guarded. And maybe my preference, if I had to choose, is going to be, I would rather have it a governmental function, have it a governmental function versus outsourcing it to private entities.
So to give you an idea of who we interacted with at this exercise, the script was written by civilian contractors. Now they were all recently separated from the military. And I think it was Booz Allen or one of those big ones, right? But they were experts on that script. But hear me out. They were experts on that script because they wrote it. And that's all they did was they went from one exercise to another and they just kept hammering the script. So they knew exactly what to do. They knew all of the little oddball questions and how to fix the system. And there's a whole, you know, this isn't all done over FM radio. Most of it is done over a network and they're experts on that system within the network. That's not really military. Like we don't really have somebody that like all they do is one system, one exercise, back to back to back to back. So we got more out of the exercise because they stepped in as the subject matter experts.
Maybe. If you're chasing the results, if you're chasing the process, maybe it's a healthier process to have someone like you doing it, a young major, rather than someone who's been ingrained in this. We know that the active, and I think this goes back to your reserve National Guard distinction between active. We do, and I totally understand what you're saying. And I agree with you, especially back then, that feeling of like, there's no way that these guys compete. However, getting away from it a bit, there's something to be said for when you are in the military, you're in a microcosm of a universe that is not quite reality compared to the regular society. I mean, you are really doing your own thing. Doesn't matter what anybody else is doing. And the Guard and reservists, they get healthy influxes of real life. You know, like you might have a specialist in the reserves or guard that is like, could be a MBA even, college educated, white collar guy that works at Procter & Gamble or something.
You get everything.
Yeah, married with kids.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And bills to pay. Whereas in the military, in active, you're being handheld and escorted to your dental clinics. So there's sort of more big boy rules of having to show up, of personal autonomy and accountability in the reserves and National Guard than you would have in active, I would say, which I think is going to help perspectives because what you always just want are people with like sort of common sense, good judgment. And I think that that's developed over time through experiences. And so I think that varied experiences are going to help facilitate that. And that I think also goes towards my point that I'm always sort of ranting about is like, maybe the military is too professional. That's always my fear of being the redcoats. We're just too organized, too professional. When to me, the military is supposed to be, let's say, more the guard and reservist, meaning, hey, I'm just an everyday dude. I'm got this duty to go help out sort of everybody. But at the end of the day, I just want to go home to my farm and my kids and inject into my community. I'm not trying to put boots on ground on every single continent on earth. That's not the point. And I think the Guard and the Reserve sort of embody that.
Yeah, I mean, so I only saw a very small piece of this training exercise, but I will say it was very broad, the kind of injects that would hit the units. It wasn't like this road is closed, now you have to go down that road and there were people waiting to ambush them or something. it would be very high level general things to where the unit had a lot of flexibility to figure out how to problem solve within that new environment. Like there is a high risk of a chemical attack in the next 6 hours. So they have to adjust to the likelihood of a chemical. That could mean anything. Every unit might treat that a little bit differently. Some might shut off operations. Some might try to get operations done before that window's over. Some might add mop gear, whatever it is. But it wasn't very directed. It was very left and right limits, I'd say, and let the unit figure out what to do within that.
That's the way.
From what I could see. From my little great. Window.
Yeah, I think when we're talking left and right limits, I think that that's what's awesome. Giving someone discretion to make decisions within a tolerance and to making sure they're staying, you know, the supervisor, whomever, the boss is making sure they're within those left and right limits, but let them figure it out and don't tell them exactly how you would have done it. They got a sort of the beauty of these things, JRTCs, pre-deployment trainings, is the attitude of train to failure. And so I think a part of these scripts, what they're doing, it, when they're saying a chemical attack, well, things are probably going pretty well. And we can't have things go well all the time. We have to influx it with just variables and things that we weren't expecting that we now have to deal with. And there's no perfect answer here. We just need to come up with something and move on. And how are we going to handle those scenarios? And failing through it is part of the process, and really directly bringing up those failures after the fact. I think that that's an excellent thing that the military does. And I, in that regard, I think the system works.
And for anybody who hasn't been through these exercises, the way that usually works is it, with that example, let's say there's a threat of a chemical attack in the next 6 hours. If the unit does nothing, something bad usually happens. So if they say, whatever, we're just going to go about our day like nothing happened, and they ignore it, or they don't even pass that information on, then they might actually get hit with a chemical attack and things start to fall apart. But there's a lot of discretion on the observers to be able to say, okay, they took action, or they didn't take action, or they tried, let's mess with them a little bit. So it's not, when I say script, the script is more for the scenario around the units. It's not dictating everything that's going to happen to the unit. That's really driven by how they act, which is pretty cool.
I think in a good example of one of those situations would have been, hey, look, battalion has word that there's a VBID in the AO. VBID meaning like a vehicle-borne IED, suicide bomber in a car, in our area of operations. And so all the companies get that report. And same thing, what do you do? And because that's a new intelligence. And if you had this idea that, hey, we were doing X today and we're going to do X no matter what, we've got to patrol at 10 a.m. because we got to do all these things. We got to resupply. And I'm going to put a skeleton crew back at the COP, at the outpost. Come hell or high water, I'm doing those things. You're not responding to reality. Reality is there's a potential VBID in the area. And you sure as hell better be doing stand to and getting people alert and making sure that your wire is pushed out. You got the like this little serpentine thing. As soon as you get that information, you need to take action. And those that don't, bad things happen in the training events. But that's also true in real life, you know, is not responding to that intelligence to the best of your ability. You can't control that some guy that we don't know who he looks, what he looks like or who he is literally driving around looking for a spot where he can kill himself and take as many of us out as possible. That is the fact. And so we now need to control what our abilities are. And that is just to just mitigate it, because you cannot 100% absolutely prevent it.
So yeah, I think it's cool how it was interesting to see that kind of on display behind the scenes a little bit. Again, I only got a little bit of a glimpse. There's hundreds or even thousands of people involved in setting these up and executing these things. And I was, you know, again, very, very little window to the overall process, but it's pretty cool. Yeah. I think that'll wrap it up for today, but we got a couple more good conversations and interviews coming up in the next few weeks that I'm excited about. So anything to wrap up with there, Sarah?
No. No, like I said, this is fun for me to live vicariously through you.
I like it. All right.
I'm out of the game.
We'll see y'all next time.
All right.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you like what we're doing, we'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a review on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on. It helps us get in front of new listeners and provides feedback on how we're doing. We'll see you next time.